Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the show, the backlash against bottled water, population growth, immigration, and the environment, and also that hybrid vehicle you're driving. Are you being exposed to dangerous levels of electromagnetic radiation? All of this. Back with us, Jim Motovalli is executive editor of the new mass media newspaper. He's senior writer at E, the environmental magazine. Jim's latest book, Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. Jim Motovalli, welcome back.
Great to be on.
And we're at 614-292-8513. You can email a comment or question to openline at WOSU.org. Jim, your New York Times article. Some people fear that hybrid gas electric cars, you know, I mean, Honda's got one, Toyota's got a couple, there's the Ford Escape and others, that they're flooding the passenger compartment with dangerous electromagnetic radiation. What do we know?
Well, this is one of those stories that is being very hotly discussed online. If you go, you know, if you were to Google this, you're going to find lots of anxious owners posting concern about this on the, you know, the websites of owner groups and things like that. And you can buy a $150 meter. It's called the Gauss meter.
Mm-hmm.
And you can test your car for electromagnetic radiation. And some people have been doing this and finding that this radiation, which is the same kind of concern that people have about power lines,
sure,
or cell phones, or even Wi-Fi networks, that this invisible electromagnetic radiation could possibly be affecting them and could cause cancer. Now, the science on EMFs, as we call them, is very inconclusive. There are studies linking it to leukemia. There are studies exonerating it. There are studies all over the map. And it is impossible to conclude after, you know, doing a pretty extensive look at this, to simply say that EMFs are going to cause cancer is really a stretch given what the science is. But to be concerned about it, there's ample reason to do that. And the car makers will tell you that their cars emit very low levels of EMF radiation. But if you were to take one of these cheap Gauss meters and check your car, you might get a fairly high reading, a reading that is of concern. Now, the U.S. government does not regulate EMF radiation, and it's something you would actually get from something as simple as your toaster.
Mm-hmm.
That puts out a lot. The thing is that your toaster is one thing; it's only on for a couple minutes,
sure,
and you're not likely to be standing right next to it when it is on. And that contrasts with what happens in your car. You might be sitting over this radiation for several hours,
sure,
while you're driving.
Yeah.
That is what gives people some concern.
So it's an electromagnetic field. And in your New York Times article, Toyota, in terms of their Prius and their hybrid Camry, responded and said, look, we've measured this ourselves. And, you know, there's less EMF in our car than there is in a standard gasoline-powered car.
Right. They say that, but they also declined to release their actual results.
Hmm.
With some reason, they don't actually release all their crash test results either. That was the analogy they made to me. You know, it's sort of proprietary, and they're worried about competitive advantage, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But they'll tell you that their results were really low. Both Honda and Toyota said that to me. But it doesn't explain why the average person using one of these meters gets a high reading. And if I was able to persuade the New York Times to spend $4,000 or $5,000, we could have done a professional test on a hybrid Camry or a Prius or something like that, but they weren't willing to go that far. So, so it remains a fairly undecided issue, I would say.
So first of all, as you say, we don't know whether EMF even at a high intensity causes leukemia or anything else. We don't know that. The science is unclear. And secondly, it seems to be unclear now what the EMF level is in these hybrid cars.
There's a lot more concern about it in Europe.
Hmm.
And most of the studies on, say, cell phones, and there's an association between cell phones and brain cancer. And again, it's mostly European studies. And there's other studies exonerating it in the same basic scientific throw weight, you could say, saying that there is no link between brain cancer and cell phone use. And I've seen European articles that talk about Wi-Fi networks and say we really shouldn't be having these fields in our house. And, you know, when you start looking about at all the EMF fields that we are subjected to, it's everywhere. It's all around us. So
sure.
If we started regulating EMF, it would be a very, very big deal.
I mean, somebody's got a router in their house so they can have a wireless connection in their house. You got an EMF field
right
there.
Right, you do, yeah.
So what's what's an environmentally conscious person about to purchase a new car to do? Go with the hybrid or say, wait a minute, maybe I'd better not?
I don't think this is a reason not to buy a hybrid car, really. I think the advantages of a hybrid far outweigh the disadvantages at this point.
Possible cancer.
I would buy.
Possible cancer is the disadvantage?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
is that the
right,
disadvantage?
Right.
So, but you get better gas mileage.
Yeah, you get great gas mileage while you're getting dosed.
I mean, this is. You say some people online have written that they've returned their cars to dealers, huh?
Yes, some people have returned their cars. I interviewed four or five people that had either just sold their cars or returned it to a dealer at a loss, or they've done something to not. So, well, I interviewed three or four people who say they have physical symptoms driving their hybrid car.
That sounds a little. That's hard to believe. I mean,
there's a woman on Staten Island who I interviewed is in that story, who says she gets severe headaches and drowsiness every time she drives her Honda Civic Hybrid, and she can't stay awake, and she never had this problem before. Is she the most reliable, you know, scientific witness? I don't know, but I talked to a nurse who also had severe symptoms, which she was able to describe to me from her Toyota Camry Hybrid, which she also sold. And she didn't necessarily associate that with EMF. She just said she had these symptoms.
Interesting.
And I talked to another Toyota Camry owner that had similar problems with it. And then I talked to a guy who owned one of those GS470, I can't remember the exact designation, the very fancy Lexus hybrid. And he had problems with physical sensations also. So I talked to maybe four or five people that said they had this problem.
How did you find those people?
Again, if you go online, if you were to just Google hybrid EMF, you're going to find a lot of this stuff.
Sure.
And most of these people I found posted on owners' boards, you know, associated with hybrid ownership.
So what did you come away, what's your takeaway from all this research? What did you conclude?
I think that we should be studying this more. I think it would be great if some organization with a little money was able to just do very professional testing of hybrids to see what kind of results they get.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be all that expensive. Probably for $30,000, you could test every known hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would kind of set the matter to rest. If there's even protocols that have been developed for testing hybrids, but they've never been used.
Do you drive a hybrid?
I'm a car reviewer, so I tend to drive test cars. I have a different one every week.
Okay. Well, interesting. Jim Motovalli.
That includes a lot of hybrids.
A lot of hybrids. Jim Motovalli, senior writer at E! The Environmental Magazine, executive editor of the new mass media newspapers. We're at 614-292-8513. If you'd like to join the conversation, email to openline@wosu.org. We've got hybrid cars that you can plug in on the way, if anybody wants them at this point, right?
Yes. Well, I think plug-in hybrids are sort of the next generation of hybrids. And I think both General Motors and Toyota will have them on the road in a couple of years. And the GM example is kind of a little different. It's a type of hybrid, but one we haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And it has – I wrote about this form of hybrid in my book Forward Drive in 2000, but it's interesting. It has a gasoline engine, but the gasoline engine is not connected to the wheels. It is a very small gas motor, and its whole purpose is to keep the batteries charged. So it's essentially an electric car with a range extender from the gas engine. That's called the Chevrolet Volt.
Yes.
And GM is having great success working on that. It's got lithium-ion batteries, and it really should be on the market by 2010, 2011.
Okay. And so this will be GM's first venture. Well, not is it their first venture into something? Do they have a hybrid on the market right now, GM?
They do, but they're sort of hybrids in name only. There's a Chevy Malibu hybrid. There's a Silverado hybrid. They're what called mild hybrids. There's not a huge hybrid effect, but they're a step in the right direction. They don't have a full-blown hybrid yet, though. Actually, they come to think of it, they do. They have these dual-mode hybrids that are only seen in the big SUVs, which seems the wrong way to go for to me.
So they get instead of 12 miles a gallon, they get 17.
Exactly, Fred. That's exactly the problem. They don't really, when you're starting with a big, heavy vehicle and you put a hybrid drivetrain in it, and you still got the big V8 or whatever, you're not going to make a huge gain. This is what Amory Lovins talks about when he talks about the hypercar. You got to start with a really light, purpose-built platform. And so far, the domestic manufacturers seem reluctant to do that. The Volt is the first real departure from just hybridizing their big cars, which seems the wrong way to go to me.
This is analogous to the big McMansions that you've commented about, you know, that they're environmentally sound. They have all, they have the solar cells, they have the this, they have the that, but they're 4,000 square feet. And by the
Yeah, well,
way,
not 4,000, 10,000.
yeah.
I just wrote a story about Greenwich, Connecticut, which is one of the wealthiest towns in the United States, and it was about green building in Greenwich. And there really is a whole lot of it, and people are putting in things like geothermal installations and solar panels and using all the latest environmental technology with paints and stuff. But the houses are so big, they're like 10,000 square feet, that it kind of defeats the purpose. They're still using, you know, a whole lot of electricity and resources. But, you know, in Greenwich, about the only thing that isn't negotiable is the size of the house.
Yeah. Well, let's say Al Gore's house, right? This huge house, and he has all these wonderful things in it. But
right,
and
he
he's been
offsets
criticized
all
for.
his power.
Yeah.
Al Gore, it's what they call carbon offset. So, you know, for every bit of electricity he uses, he plants a tree or something like that.
Well,
And that's what a lot of people are doing.
let me hear, because interesting you say that, because here's Don joining us on the phone. Don, you have a question about carbon offsets, right?
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
Thank you. We know that in Europe, these things are already in place. They've had a carbon tax there for 9 years. And we know that the carbon tax works because, well, the only thing that companies will understand is if you hit them in the pocketbook. So, as far as personal carbon offsets here, like you're talking about with Al Gore, I'm wondering how long he thinks it's going to be before they're ubiquitous here, that you'll be able to offset everything. There's companies like TerraPass and Carbon Fund where you can go now and buy offsets for your entire life.
Yeah.
And it's about $125 a year per person to offset your entire, if you average it out.
Well, what do they do then? If you offset, you give them 125 bucks, and what do they do?
Well, they plant trees, or they go into other rainforest projects and things like that to try to mitigate your carbon. That's why they call it the carbon offset. You try to balance yourself out and become carbon neutral.
Yeah.
By doing things that will help the environment equally as much as the damage you cause just by living every day.
Okay. Jim Motovalli, what do you think of this idea of carbon offsets?
That was a very cogent explanation of the issue, yes. And people can do this. It's entirely voluntary in the U.S. No one is telling you have to offset your carbon. But there are a number of things people are doing voluntarily to maybe feel good about themselves as environmental citizens beyond just, you know, throwing stuff in the recycling bin. One example of that is buying green power. This is something that I'm involved in here in Connecticut. And hopefully you have that opportunity out there. But through your utility, you should be able to buy clean energy.
Yeah, we
essentially
do have
what it means is a few dollars more on your electricity bill, and then the company that operates that will buy, say, wind power or solar power and put that into the grid, again, offsetting your electric use.
Mm-hmm. But our carbon offsets, I mean, if I give a company 125 bucks a year, you know, to plant trees, and I've got this big house and I'm using all these utilities, I mean, is that a cop-out?
You can look at it that way, but it's certainly better than doing nothing.
Yeah.
I don't really see it that way. I think that it's a pretty positive step, and it's pretty, you know, you really should move to a smaller house. You don't really need 10,000 square feet. But if you're not going to do that, offsetting your carbon is certainly a good thing. I don't blame Al Gore for that. I do think he doesn't need so much space, probably.
Don, what do you think?
I think that carbon offsets, people are, everybody's a little bit green, I think, and becoming more green every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's like recycling was never in vogue, but it is now, out by the curb. You know, we're always loath to change because humans are creatures of habit. But I think people are looking for a way to be able to be greener in a way where they can feel like they're contributing instead of, you know, to the good instead of always contributing to the carbon problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one thing it'll be able to do. It'll change mindsets. And, of course, it does assuage guilt. But it's just like in the old Catholic Church, you know, you'd buy offsets for your sins, basically. And that's what this is, only they're your carbon sins. But
okay.
It's a tough sell because you really are not handing anybody anything when they give you your $125 except certificates saying that you know they're carbon neutral. So,
sure.
But I think it will stimulate education and knowledge. And when the carbon tax comes in the next Congress, we'll all be forced to look at this because then the costs come involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then companies, of course, have to explain why that they're charging you more. So, but I think it's a big thing that's coming, and it's coming like a freight train, and I don't think you're going to see it stop. It's just going to get more and more ubiquitous as time goes on.
Sure. Well, Don, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
And so, in other words, Jim, if I fly over to Europe or over to Asia, I mean, that's putting a lot of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, but I can buy
That's a very good example because even people who live very green and have Priuses and all that, they probably – if they're, in the upper income category, they probably fly a fair amount, and that will wipe out all your gains, all your, hybrid car ownership and
sure, all
recycling
that stuff.
And all that, because you will really create a lot of tons of carbon by doing that, by flying.
You know, I wonder how they're going to. In other words, there's a huge amount of carbon in the atmosphere because of airplane flights, but I don't see people not flying, you know, not going to see friends and relatives, not going on vacation. I don't see fewer flights unless, of course, fuel prices get so high that they're already cutting back for them. So I wonder how they're going to deal with that as a greenhouse gas producer. Airplanes will always be there.
Well, there have been some reforms, like not having planes idle on the runway as much. And I think we could make much more fuel-efficient planes. And there already are like prototype fuel cell airplanes, which would emit no carbon. If we could get to that, we could probably create a zero carbon airline industry, but that's still quite a ways off, I would say.
Sure. Good idea to move toward, though.
I mean, the airplanes could be powered by electric motors with onboard fuel cells. Right now, I think going up in a combination of that might be a little risky because fuel cells are still very experimental, but we're making a lot of progress with them.
Surely. Let's go next to Marty. Hi, Marty. You're on the air.
Hey, Fred. Hey, Jim. I've been holding my cell phone in my head. You guys are making me nervous here. I think I'm going to have to go get a checkup. anyway, my comment was about the electromagnetic waves. I think pretty much I'm pretty sure that any waves that can travel through your body, infrared, gamma, X-rays, all of those, could possibly do some cell damage and possibly cause cancer in the long run. So if you've got some high tension lines right over your house and they're constantly pouring out electromagnetic waves, I think that kind of is a real concern. Has the government ever done any tests to take a look at, do they cause tumors in people? Do they cause cancer in people? What levels does it take? And is there any way that they can possibly just bury these electromagnetic lines instead of having them above people's houses and above the public?
Well, the government has done analysis of the existing scientific research. Most of the research comes out of academic circles and is published in academic journals. And various government agencies have analyzed that. And I would say the usual conclusion is that there's a weak link between electromagnetic waves and cancer and other ills. And the weak link is because there may be a preponderance of studies that say it's not dangerous, but there's a small number of persistent and authoritative studies say that it is. So all the government has done is basically said, this is what the literature says. and it's impossible to draw a firm and ironclad conclusion from that. And, you know, a lot of people on the blogosphere, if you look at the reaction to my article, they want to say something definitive, to say, it's nuts to worry about this, or this is a huge concern. I think if you read my actual article in the New York Times, it doesn't say either one of those things. It says, "This there's a concern out here about this, and it's scientifically unproven."
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think.
Okay, Marty?
Hey, thanks, Jim. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks. And hello, Al. You're on the air.
Hi, Fred. This is not Al Gore, but let me make a few comments. I think cancer, you know, we all worry about cancer, but I wrote a paper that came out at end of last year in Medical Hypotheses that we produce carcinogens ourselves. So that the concept that we don't produce cancer-causing compounds is probably illusory. We produce them ourselves, and that could be a major cause of why some people develop cancer and others don't.
You're talking just about in our body itself.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly. In other words, there are endogenous, naturally occurring compounds that we can produce in our own body that can produce cancer. And so maybe this electromagnetic radiation is really a very minor thing in terms of individuals.
Okay.
The question I had is, we really have a major problem with liquid hydrocarbons. In South Africa, they developed a Sasol program in which they liquefied a coal because they had a lot of coal and very little hydrocarbons. And the question I wondered is, with the price of oil so high, why wouldn't that be an effective way of generating enough hydrocarbons for the United States at this point, since we have really very large resources of coal,
mm-hmm.
and that maybe when electric cars come along, we're going to be in a much better position, so that this would take us off being dependent upon Middle Eastern oil, and we can move forward in terms of using our coal as a means of. And I wondered if you'd comment
sure.
about that.
Sure. Jim, what about liquefying coal?
No, you walk right into that one, buddy. I got to tell you, that is one of the worst ideas currently on the agenda.
Okay.
And it is being advanced by coal state senators as you say, an alternative to Middle Eastern oil. There are many huge problems with this. One, the process is incredibly dirty and incredibly messy and incredibly expensive. To be competitive financially, I think gas would have to get to $6 or $7 a gallon, which I think it is going to do. So it's possible that it could get economically viable. But if you look at the way we extract coal in the United States, it is the worst environmental damage possible. We do something called mountaintop removal mining. And this is the coal that would be the basis for liquid coal, because it's the cleaner burning coal that we get out of Appalachia. If you go down to a state like West Virginia, which I did, and you see mountaintop removal mining in person, it's the most horrific thing you could possibly imagine. We essentially take the tops off of mountains. Imagine an ice cream scoop or an ice cream cone. And you take off all the ice cream level with a cone. That's what essentially what it looks like.
Yeah.
You've taken off the top of the mountain just to get directly to the coal seam. So instead of having miners go underground, you just have these enormous, enormous trucks that are even too big to go on the public roads. They have to assemble them on the job sites, moving, just going directly into the coal seam and carrying out the coal that way. It's very cheap and efficient to do it that way. But they take the top of the mountain that they've just removed and they dump it into the valley alongside the mountain, thereby blocking all the mountain streams that come through there, and in many cases destroying the water supply for the towns that are at the base of those mountains. This has happened hundreds and even thousands of times in Appalachia. There's whole communities that are no longer habitable because of this. It's the most environmentally destructive practice I've ever seen, and that is at the basis of clean coal. Also, the fact that the process is so dirty that the amount of greenhouse gas that you generate in the process is far more than with gasoline.
Hmm.
So this is not a solution to our problems with peak oil at all.
Al, do you have, Al, a quick comment before we break?
Sure. If you have so much coal, you might try using hydrogen in order to convert the carbon into liquid. And, you know, just because the process now is a dirty one doesn't mean that technology and scientific developments couldn't develop this to a point that it might be useful until we get electric cars.
Well,
thank you.
That may be in the future, but right now we have only a very dirty and pretty embryonic process, which,
yeah,
as the caller said, was developed in South Africa. And my guess is it won't happen. But, you know, if you look at other things that are being discussed, one is oil shale. We have vast amounts of this in the Rocky Mountains, and it's essentially rock that has a lot of oil impregnated into it. And in order to get that out, we got to go through an incredibly dirty process again, using tons of water, lots of air pollution. It's a real messy thing, and there's a reason we haven't developed those resources. The problem is,
Jim, let's hold that thought if you would. We're going to take a break here. I'd like to talk more about that extraction from oil shale. Jim Motovalli, executive editor of the New Mass Media Newspaper, senior writer at E! The Environmental Magazine. Call us. We'll be right back after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Cleveland is at the center of the home foreclosure crisis. Just the cost of demolishing abandoned homes taxes the city, where an official says
it's $6 and $7 million that we should have been using for roads, infrastructure, schools. Instead, we're borrowing money to eliminate nuisance conditions like this.
The foreclosure crisis up close, plus all the week's news, and Mel Brooks Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Weekend Edition Saturday, tomorrow morning beginning at 8 a.m. Now on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News and Classical Music. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. It is 59 degrees at 10:34. Corporate partners help provide support for the programming on WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, active audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine Shodich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News. In the forecast for today, partly sunny, partly cloudy skies. There is a slight chance of rain later today, a high around 65.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer. In partnership with the Nature Conservancy, Meijer is helping customers identify and select non-invasive plants for Ohio backyards. Information is available at nature.meijer.com.
Welcome back to Open Line, WOSU 820, NPR News. We're talking about issues in our American environment. Jim Motovalli back with us. He's senior writer at E! The Environmental Magazine and executive editor of the New Mass Media Newspapers. Jim's latest book is called Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email a comment or question to openline at wosu.org. Jim, before we go back to our callers, you wrote a piece on the issue of scrap metal and the fact that so much metal is being stolen because the price is so high.
Right. That was for those New Mass Media newspapers, and it's online. People could find it there. But it's a really interesting phenomenon. It's nationwide that as we get sort of economically pinched, as the economy worsens, One thing that people can do if they're entrepreneurial is collect scrap metal, because there are these, if you call them junkyards or scrap yards, all over the country that buy scrap metal. And there's particularly high prices now for copper and for brass. And some of the people who are collecting this stuff aren't too particular where they get it. In some cases, it may mean that your gutters are going to disappear. Or in England, it means that the lead in the roofs of churches is starting to disappear. In Connecticut here, we've actually had people steal whole statues and plaques that are on statues for the metal value. And you know, it's probably worth a few bucks as scrap metal, but recreating the statue or recreating the plaque is a real big job. So we've seen that. In fact, someone in Connecticut was recently arrested for attempting to steal an entire swimming pool. It was in an above-ground pool. And they'd actually dismantled the whole pool and had it in the car when the police got up with them. And this is all, you know, just to collect a few dollars in scrap value. And in Connecticut, I'm not sure of other states, a few states are starting to enact laws about this. And one thing you can do is when people bring in scrap metal, you can, you know, require that they show their license and give all their out their IDs and you collect their license plate number and that kind of stuff. Connecticut now requires that so that if the police are trying to track some stolen scrap metal, they can find this paper trail. And hopefully that would intimidate thieves. But considering how much theft there's going on, the thieves don't exactly seem too worried about it.
Probably going to increase.
It increases as the price of the metals go up.
Yeah, sure.
And one thing we've seen a whole lot, and this will probably increase too, is the theft of catalytic converters off cars.
Yes.
Now, that is not an easy thing to do. You've got to get under the car with a Sawzall and really start hacking away at it. I would think that would be fairly conspicuous, but catalytic converters contain a precious metal known as platinum, which is in very short supply, and you need it for catalytic converters. And most of the platinum in catalytic converters is recycled in just this way. So it's kind of ironic, really. I mean, people stealing catalytic converters, the platinum goes back to make more catalytic converters. Those are stolen. Kind of a vicious circle, if you look at it that way.
Well, gee, maybe all these thieves of these different metals think of themselves as recyclers.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. Junkyards now routinely bill themselves that way, and they are. If you look at cars, about 70% of the automobile is now recycled, which is pretty good.
That's good, yeah.
Yeah.
Back to our call. It's at 614-292-8513. Nancy's on the line. Hello, Nancy.
Hi. I was wondering, you said something way back earlier in this segment about carbon neutral and people could get maybe a certificate. I don't know if I heard that right, but it made me think, do you believe that we could get people to do things more responsibly if we gave them an incentive? If you go vote, you get a little sticker that says, I voted today. Or if you give blood, you get a little badge that said, I gave. And I was thinking, I noticed, I write the website for the Rachel Carson Council, and what I do is I take epidemiological studies and I put it in lay terms so people can understand, and I pass out flyers and so forth, and no one would read my flyers about pesticides being carcinogenic until I got Jeannie Schultz, the widow of Charles Schultz, to donate Snoopy. And then suddenly everybody wanted to read it, and if you go online you can see it. And so I would stand out at the Veterinarians Association conventions, and in the past years they wouldn't read my literature, but now they do because they see Snoopy. So if we got or people to go organic, maybe we could get like totally organic Snoopy dancing signs that you put in the yard, and so every kid would want it. Or, do you know what I mean? To promote people so they feel good about doing the right thing.
Not sure, Snoopy power. You know, I do think that the organizations that do these carbon offsets, they'll send you a certificate and it says, you know, it looks very official and all that. It doesn't have any real force of law because, as I said, there's no law requiring anyone to limit their carbon emissions. It's all a goodwill type of thing. If you want to get a plaque and put it on your wall, you can do that. But I think most of the people doing this now are pretty motivated environmentalists. They probably don't need Snoopy, really, to get them going, but...
But
But more power to you for doing
that. If you have something that symbolizes that you're doing the right thing, then maybe kids would say, Mom, I want that too, rather than a stay off the grass sign.
Well, I do think kids today are getting a pretty good environmental curriculum, and they're learning a lot about environmental issues. And in many cases, they're more sophisticated than their parents are about that.
Good.
You know, I have two kids, and there's some issues they do know a fair amount about. Their friend actually knows a whole lot more than they do, but,
I know if we make people feel good about doing the right thing that they can show, like maybe we could have a sticker to put on a car that says, I traded in my SUV for this.
Hmm. Actually, I'm working on a story that's going to be about kid global warming activists. And essentially, I'm thinking of kids in middle school. And I know maybe four or five of them that have an amazing amount of knowledge and have done incredible work in raising awareness about global warming. I know a kid that has spoken like 100 times to audiences about global warming, and he's in eighth grade. And that kind of activism, I think, is very encouraging to me.
Thanks, Nancy. Thanks for your call. Jim, I remember there used to be a sticker you could download from the Internet, a bumper sticker you could send away for it. And some environmental activists were slapping these on the rear bumpers of Hummers. And it went something like, ask me how I'm changing the planet. I don't know if this is still available. In the major issue of E! The Environmental Magazine cover article, The Backlash Against Bottled Water. What's that?
I write a lot of things, don't I?
Yeah.
Yes, there is a big backlash against bottled water that I think is entirely justified. It's one of my pet peeves. Everything about the bottled water industry is unsustainable. It's exactly like the SUV as a concept. It is really based on an irrational idea. The SUV never really met people's needs. It was based on this, I think, really off idea that you needed to be an individualist and the minivan was for squares, and somehow you were aside from the herd when you bought an SUV, and it symbolized the open road, which is, and your ability to go anywhere, which is absurd because 90% of them never leave the highway.
Sure.
The bottled water phenomenon is in response to a perceived inadequacy of the public water supply that doesn't actually exist. We have really good public water in the United States. And in some cases, the bottled water industry, which is incredibly lucrative for the beverage industry and represents the next step for them after people started getting health conscious and worried about all the sugar and soft drinks, it is incredibly profitable for them. And if you think about it, bottling water usually from a public water source and then selling it to you for like $1 or $2 a bottle is about as much a dream for the industry as you could have.
I remember there was one bottled water on the market a while back, and you look carefully, and it says, from the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania water supply.
Right. 40% of the bottled water on the market is from public water supplies. It's just filtered water, and the tap water is filtered too.
Mm-hmm.
And people have somehow gotten in mind that their tap water is not safe to drink. And there are really very few places in the United States where that's true. But you also have to factor in the fact that bottled water has to be packaged in these plastic bottles that end up as litter everywhere around the country. And it also has to be transported and shipped. And the environmental cost of the whole procedure is just outstandingly bad. And it's entirely unnecessary. There's really nothing wrong with our tap water. People could save a whole lot of money by not buying bottled water.
I saw somebody the other day with Fiji water, and apparently that does come from the Fiji Islands.
It indeed does, and that happens to be one of my biggest pet peeves about bottled water, is that Fiji water. Now, this gets into what we were talking about earlier, because Fiji water has been getting bad press because of how far the water has to travel before it's on our shelves. And really, water from a spring in Fiji is no better than water from a spring in the United States. It's just totally a marketing thing. But stung by this criticism, Fiji Water announced that it was going to offset all its carbon. And that what that says to me is not that you should now buy Fiji Water. What it says is that they are making so much money selling that product, which I think is on most supermarket shelves now, it certainly is in my supermarket, whole racks of it, that they can afford easily to offset all their carbon. But it doesn't, to me, it does not make that a product people should buy.
You know, it is a wonderful scheme, is it not, to take water from the public water supply, pass it through a carbon filter, which we could do, you know, on our own taps, for that matter, and sell it for 10 times what you paid for it.
Exactly.
That's great.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to our callers. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I called in before you made your last remark about filtering water at home, which certainly is a good answer to this problem. But I think we are missing one point when you say the public water supply is safe, and that is the authorities are concerned about biological contamination. But the remedy to prevent that is a degree of chemical contamination. The microbes are going to make you sick right now, but the chemical effects are more long-term. I remember 15 or 20 years ago, it's quite a long time ago, and maybe things have gotten better, but the screaming headlines in the Columbus papers were studies that showed that Columbus had the second worst drinking water in the country after New Orleans. So
I don't think that's true anymore, by the way. I think we've vastly improved the system here.
Good. I hope it's true.
I think one of the factors of bottled water is that towns are losing support for the public water supply and resources to keep the public water supply as good as it can be.
Mm.
If people aren't using it, it's going to lose public support.
Mm.
And I think that's a danger, that we could end up with unsafe water, which we don't have right now. We have very safe drinking water.
I think
there's nothing wrong with it. The only real issue that I see in drinking tap water is that if you have an older house, you may have lead pipes coming from the water supply.
Yes, and that's true of a number of homes in Columbus. That's right.
And I think there is a reason, and it's not very expensive. It's not hard to do either, to filter your water with like a Brita water filter or one of those carafe things.
Sure.
And a lot of people do that, and I think that's a good solution. Certainly isn't as environmentally bad as bottled water is.
Also removes some of the chlorine, the chlorination, does it?
Yes.
Not? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And lead.
And lead, yeah.
Okay, the chlorine was the thing I've been most offended by with the public water in the past. And I don't know whether they've lightened that up or not.
But you can filter that at home, isn't
it? You can filter it. Yeah. And if you don't filter at home, you can buy filtered water and reuse the bottles, and you get the number 2 type gallon jugs you can recycle. Which has some carbon imprint there, I'm sure. But
some. It'll help some. John, thank you.
Okay.
Amy is here. Hello, Amy.
Hi. I just... listening to the bottled water conversation, I don't mind my tap water, except it doesn't taste very good to me. But I use a lot of bottled water because, not because I'm concerned about the water, our regular water, but it's easy to take it with me. And I've lost a lot of weight by drinking water rather than soda and having it in my vehicle with me when I travel. So what's the solution? Because I don't want to use these plastic bottles anymore, and I'm not opposed to the city water or anything like that, but it's the portability and the access. You know, I can have a case of water in my car, and I have access to water all the time. So do you have a solution for that or a suggestion?
Yes. Well, I would suggest taking a look at a Swiss-made water bottle called SIGG, S-I-G-G.
Okay.
That is scientifically engineered so that the plastic from the bottle doesn't leach into the water. One problem with reusing, say, you know, a water bottle from, Poland Spring or whatever, is that over time those bottles become brittle, and the plastic can leach into the water.
Right, I had heard that.
You're better off. These bottles cost about $20. These SIGG bottles, and I keep that with me, and it's guaranteed not to do that, and you can reuse it endlessly.
Hmm.
Well, but I'm talking about, you know, I'll drink 5 or 6 bottles of water, you know, in 4 or 5 hours. You know, I'm trying to get my water and all of that, and I do a lot of walking. So, I mean, that's kind of an expensive solution.
Well, not filling up a SIGG water bottle from the tap is not an expensive
solution. Well, but if I want 5 of them, you know, to have that. I mean, that's $100.
Well, you have to keep refilling it.
Amy, how much water do you drink in a day?
That sounds like an awful lot of water.
Yeah.
Well,
these are big bottles.
Oh, they are? Because I'm talking about, you know, I've got, like, right now, I've got, one of these little 500-milliliter bottles, and I probably drink, you know, at least six of those during the day.
Well, that's good. You should be drinking that much water, but you may have to go through the refilling process. It's really not that onerous.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I will look for that. I guess I don't have any problems with filling it up in that. It's just for me, it's just been so convenient.
Sure, I understand. Yeah. There are probably circumstances where it is convenient to have the bottled water, but I think there are creative ways around that, Jim, huh? Thanks, Amy, for your call, 614.
I'm not trying to discourage people from drinking water. You really should be drinking 8 glasses a day, and I try to do that. But if you can get away from the bottled water, you're really helping the planet.
By the way, I saw a study which said, where did we get this idea that we should be drinking 8 glasses of water a day? And the conclusion of this particular newspaper article was that no one knew where that recommendation came from, and nobody knew whether it was true or not. So I'll just throw that out there.
I don't know where it comes from, but, I had a kidney stone recently, and a kidney stone can actually be caused by dehydration.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution to not getting it again is drinking a lot of water.
Uh-huh.
And I've definitely been working on that.
So, yeah, we know that drinking a goodly amount of water is a good idea regardless of how we measure it. By the way, we have an email from Bob. He says, Henry Ford famously wrote, big cars make big profits, small cars make small profits. He says, but now big cars and trucks make no profit at all because nobody buys them. And then Bob continues, William Clay Ford, shirking any responsibility for bad decisions made by his people, recently said, quote, the future arrived faster than we expected because of this year's sharp spike in fuel prices.
Today, Ford declared that it was not going to make a profit, and it's entirely the fault of big SUVs and pickups not selling on the market.
Uh-huh.
People are switching to small cars. Ford is ramping up production of the Focus, you know, their little car.
Sure.
Which used to be a tiny share of the market. Small cars have gone from an eighth of the market to a fifth of the market now, and that's going to climb because gas prices are not going to stay stable. They're going to continue to go up.
Surely they will. There was a piece on ABC News last night. They showed people at a parking lot in this little town. They had parked all their SUVs with for sale signs on them, and nobody was buying them.
The SUV phenomenon is effectively over, I would say.
It's done. Hello, Mary, you're on the air.
Yeah, I have a question, and then I have a comment. My question is, I find it kind of ironic that you're suggesting a Swiss water bottle. What about the carbon offsets for flying that thing from Switzerland, or those things from Switzerland? My comment is, I have a Lexus SUV, which is a crossover that gets quite good mileage, and I intend to, based upon what Consumer Reports says, keep driving that car. It's 8 years old. I'm going to keep driving it hopefully another 8 years.
What kind
what
of mileage?
Call good mileage?
Probably on the highway, 25, 26.
I don't think that's very good, to tell you the truth. I think cars today, and we actually now have this as a national goal, should be getting like 35 miles per gallon sort of as a combined average.
Well, I do a lot of highway driving, and I feel it's an extremely safe car. It's also very cheap to maintain.
Well, you're living under an illusion because SUVs are not safer than regular cars. That is another reason I didn't mention why a lot of people buy them. But I did an extensive survey of this. SUVs are basically way more dangerous than people think because of the rollover risk. They tend to be top-heavy. In an accident, they will roll over much more readily than a car. And they're also terrible on ice, which, of course, is one reason people buy them, too. Most of the idea that people think that they're living, they have a very safe car because they're sitting up high, almost all of that is wrong.
But, Jim, isn't it true that if you get hit in an SUV as opposed to getting, you know, like you would get slammed by a big pickup truck in the side in an SUV, aren't you in better shape than if you're slammed in a little compact
car? Well, that may
be,
but I drive a Honda Fit, which is the smallest car they make, and it has a 5-star crash rating in a frontal crash. It doesn't do quite as well in a rear crash, but mm-hmm. It's essentially a very safe car, and it's very, very small. Some of the smallest cars have the best crash ratings.
But if an enormous SUV hits you in the side panel in your driver's door,
I think that leads to an arms race in the size of a car. You will then conclude that nothing less than a Hummer is going to be safe, and I just think that's insane.
Well, Mary is asking, what about the carbon offset for that Swiss water bottle being transported?
Well, that was a good point. Uh-huh. There's probably a domestic alternative to that. I just happen to know about mm-hmm. this, and somebody sent me one, so I like the product. There probably are good American-made alternatives to it.
Because, you know, with some of the American-made bottles, this Nalgene bottle, apparently, there's some concern, which is, you know, a permanent plastic bottle, but apparently now there's some concern about it leaching a carcinogenic
right.
chemical into the water. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, there are concerns like that.
Let me ask you, in the few minutes left here, Jim, ethanol. We have a big controversy now about whether it's using crops needed for food. I mean, if we think of ethanol as something we can put into a car, and that maybe it's not as environmentally sound an idea. So let's talk a little about biofuels and their impact on the environment.
I think there is indeed a food versus fuel thing that's going on. And I do think ethanol is not a very good solution for our fossil fuel problems. And what is happening is that we are using an increasing amount of our corn crop to make ethanol. Mm-hmm. And in very short order, we've seen corn prices spike. And I think there are ways to make ethanol from other materials, including fast-growing grasses that will not compete with food. But and I do think cellulosic ethanol has some promise, but corn ethanol is, to me, not any kind of solution. It's a very inefficient process, and we should probably be using our corn for food and look to other methods. I think it's largely been sort of a subsidy for farm state politicians, and I think we should be ending it. I think the Brazilians have a better model making ethanol from sugar cane.
Uh-huh.
And some of the latest cellulosic results are very good, so that's what I'd like to see more developed.
But when the Brazilians are making it from sugarcane, are they tearing down rainforest?
That's an issue, too. I mean, unfortunately, almost every method we have of creating energy has downsides to it. And to me, you know, a lot of environmentalists are opposed to almost any form of energy because it does have downsides.
Mm-hmm.
But if we want the lights to come on, we really are going to have to bite the bullet and accept some negative consequences, because otherwise we become go back to being a pre-industrial society.
pretty quickly. We have Chris here with a comment. Hello, Chris.
Hi. The carbon footprint or whatever of an empty bottle is probably really small compared to cases and cases of water from Fiji or something, say.
Oh, I would, yes. That's a very good point.
And it's probably shipped over on a boat, which, you know, comes slow.
Yes. Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, Fiji water, the bottles come from China. They deliver them to Fiji. They fill them in Fiji, and then they ship it here. Then it's got to be shipped across the country to all the supermarkets. So environmental impact is huge.
Okay, Chris, thanks for the point.
And one more thing about the biofuels is it seems like the income of middle and lower class people's going down further and further relative to the rich, and this biofuels is increasing the prices of food and putting even more burden on that, separating the wealth from the lower portion of the people up to the rich more even.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks,
Fred. I think I have to get off the line because this is somebody. I'm using somebody's office, and I have to give it back to them.
And you got to give it back. Well, you're leaving about a minute early, but Jim, we want to thank you, Jim, executive editor of the New Mass Media newspaper, is also senior writer for E, the Environmental Magazine.
I always love being on the air in Ohio there, and you've got great callers, and I really appreciate it, and I'd love to do it again.
Jim Motovalli, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Bye bye. And so we got an unexpectedly early departure there by a minute, but just enough to thank Jim Motovalli. Jim's latest book is called Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. When we come back, all kinds of issues to talk about, local, national, and international, in our open forum for today. All of this on listener supported, WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus. We're streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.